The 2004 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents Session 366, Same-Sex Attraction, Spirituality, and Mormonism, The Hero's Journey, a paper presented by Martin L. Coco, with a response by Mary Moran.
Introduce our participants today. We're first going to hear from Marty Coco. Marty is from the Jewish tradition and from New York City. He was an undergraduate in history at Princeton. He tells me that C.S. Lewis had something to do with a different interest in Christianity when he was 21. He was a graduate student at Claremont, and so saw the other side of the country, but found Mormonism in Boston when he was 32 and joined the church. He has taught high school in Miami, Florida, to sort of complete his rounds of the country. Back in graduate school at Harvard, and then took a PhD in instructional academic instruction and education at Boston University. Marty has taught at BYU and is presently at Utah Valley State College. He is father of three daughters. The title of Marty's presentation today is Same-Sex Attraction, Spirituality, and Mormonism, The Hero's Journey. To respond to Marty's remarks, we welcome Mary Moran, originally from Washington, D.C. Mary's bachelor degree training was at University of Missouri, Columbia. She has a master's in social work from the University of Georgia and is currently a PhD candidate here in Salt Lake at the University of Utah in the College of Social Work. Her dissertation has to do with an examination of women's sexuality and spirituality. She has worked extensively as a therapist in mental health for 13 years. She is presently a supervisor at the Asian Association of Utah. She has a strong interest in transpersonal therapy and the role of spirituality in that kind of counseling. Mary lived in Wyoming for some time, and although it's not too far removed, tells us that she felt something like an anthropologist when she moved to Utah. Mary and her life partner, Melissa, are raising their 5-year-old child, Isaac, and we'll be very pleased to hear Mary respond to Marty's remarks.
It's been an interesting journey. 1 year ago, I came to Sunstone for my very first time as one who has a tag on, and took a look, and next thing I know, I'm submitting to a call for papers, and so here I am. I'm very, very glad to be speaking about this topic. 12 years ago, on a flight from Boston to Salt Lake City, I wrote on the back of a napkin two words. I just looked at them, and I went, what's the difference? What's the difference between happiness and joy? And some ideas danced around in my head. Man is that he might have joy, I was learning at that point. What is it to be happy? Extremely happy. Wonderfully happy. Ecstatically happy. Is it possible that you wouldn't have joy? Is there a difference? Fundamentally, is it in type? Is it in intensity? Or is it simply something of a different property between the two? 12 days ago, I was on a flight to New York when this whole writing of this talk, paper, presentation unfolded. I don't have that napkin from 12 years ago. I think it's in some file somewhere. But I do have the copy of my scribbles from, you can tell it's a Delta magazine, and there were my scribbles. So, in fact, I was successful at completing the journey on Delta to go back east, which is another story. But to go back east, maybe better come back west here and continue what I really wanted to speak about. The hero's journey. I want to present now this what I find is a 10-stage stage development, 10 steps. And there have been outstanding and significant stage development theories in the past century. The more obvious ones include Eric Erickson, my hero, my intellectual hero, Childhood and Society, The Eight Ages of Man. The book was written in 1950. Well, wonderful stuff, talking about all the tensions that we work through in our lives. Other stage theories. Fowler, religious stage development, 1978. Kohlberg, for those of you who know my field, moral development, five, six, and then he pulled back and scaled it back to five stages by the end of his life. I remind you also of M. Scott Peck. I think some of you are very well aware of his work, A Road Less Traveled, the most famous work way back. It's now over 20 years ago. Because of people of the lie, and it scared off about evil. And so a lot of, which is the subtitle, in that next book, I'm pulling a blank now, 1987, 1988, he lays out some very nice rudimentary pieces on spiritual development. Thank you. A Different Drum, Community Making, and Peace. And so from that tradition, I come up with this theoretical model building. I wasn't very good at putting together physical things, which is probably partially my Jewish culture. Don't get your hands dirty. but what I do have is I put together things, theoretical models, perhaps with words or ideas. Okay, well, I have some overheads and commentary for each step. And so really the qualitative research begins in interviews with, I simply hold on to J and K and A, three males in their 20s, the one in their 30s, one in their 40s. And each one has contributed to this story greatly. And so what I'd like to do is just take this microphone and proceed on over. What I've got is my insistence that we just live in a post-television world, and I really don't enjoy the fact when things are only auditory. So we have to go to the visual, at least for those people who are auditorily challenged. And so to just present this, very simply, I throw out my research. I'm sorry about the word the. That's very presumptuous of me. It's a 10-stage development. It's not the definitive one. I just want to contribute to the conversation. Again, from very extensive interviews from three people, we have developmental theory for Latter-day Saints who are SGA. And I want to now ask you to consider replacing the term SSA. I find the word a little bit offensive because we replaced X with NC-17. I'd like the X causes problems for a lot of people. And I'm wondering whether it is gender, but I just throw that out because I've been struggling and thinking through whether it's SSA or SGA. So I put that up there. First stage of 10, very simply. To report, it's about 2 years, by the way, 2 years of interviews. Tension, there's something rotten in the state of my soul. Pray hard. Things in common. I'm trying to just blend these three stories. Stage two, denial. To others, and especially to self. Stage three, depression, anger. Obviously, one is internal and one is external. Depression simply is anger against self, for me, from my experience. And anger is anger turning outwards. What are the issues for there? RX, go to the pills, start with Prozac in the early 90s. Head your way to Zoloft and by the late 90s and head on right into Celexa by the early 00s. Acting out or prayer? But serious prayer now. Now you got to hit your knees and don't do that in 10 minutes. Better be more like 5 hours. D, awareness. Dread. Am I alone? This is from research, by the way, all three individuals living on the Wasatch Front, deep in the heart of very, very powerfully strong LDS families or communities. Renewed commitment to the program, whatever the program is. Ah, but what would Jesus do, is my thought as I look back, also coming from an evangelical Christian tradition of 10 years of my life. E, reaction one in the stages and trying to lay out perhaps to take a closer look with the magnifying glass at going from tension all the way down to resolution. Stage five, more fervent prayer, more RX, more pills. Of course, they're legal, so hey, bring them on, right? Begin self-loathing, continued visits to the bishop's office, stronger moves towards suppression, including denial, and harder bouts of service. Okay, now I'm going to work really hard and give myself away. This is a combination here of their three stories. I'm going to serve really well. I'm going to serve literally until 16-hour days. And that service, if you're in the service of your fellow beings, that kind of service. F, drama. Ah, the drama plays out in the next stage, which seemed to be a common thread from all three. What kind of drama? Well, it could be for a day, it could be for a decade. One individual, the drama was quite interesting in his 18-hour extravaganza, wild, insane day during the Salt Lake Olympics. Another was for a decade in absolute and complete denial, playing out as he did in the middle of his marriage. Or not playing out, actually playing in. G, reaction two. Okay, we've gone that far. Now it's time for a visit to the stake president's office. Suicidal ideation or tendencies is possible. Much larger emotional upheaval. The sine curve now really begins to take off and stretch up and down, and that's where it gets really wild. H, crisis. Eighth stage, the dark night of the soul. Dying softly or living hard. These are always choices of what I've saw and took down, and there is agency upheld. Right, you can die softly, even down to a whimper, or you can live hard to the point of absolute craziness and trying to figure out, now what? Crisis. Stage 9, climax, decision. Different paths at this point now to take. Death via ecstasy or death via tragedy. But from my N equals 3, from my set of interviews, it was very obvious that there had to be a death. There had to be a death with the possibility of rebirth, resurrection. But there had to be a death. It wasn't it could be a physical death. That's up there. Hopefully it didn't get to that point. All three are still alive. But it had to be a death so that there could be the possibility of rebirth in some form or another. Well, there's J then, resolution. From the death, there was resurrection in all three. Now, the resurrection was interesting because there's a new creation, sometimes great and sometimes horrific. One person went back in and chose not to open up to the whole issue that same gender attraction was there. And so he went right back in to living his previous life. Another person, of the three, horrific, really exploded and just absolutely went wild in his newfound identity. Oh my gosh, I get who I am, and then just whew, kind of like really what the media kind of portrays those with same gender attraction on their worst case scenario really are, and that's just wildly promiscuous. Or the third, a new birth. A new birth into saying, wow, this is, I behold a new creation, and I get a second chance to live fully, even though the person happened to be in their 30s. And so that's just sort of what I wanted to pose as a stage development theory. I don't know how many there are for this topic, but because I've spent most of my post-adolescent life in academic settings reading about, studying, I wanted to try my hand at building stage development for this issue. Here's overhead number one. And you think that's it. But I have two more because the little blurb I wrote a few weeks ago kept building. And that is, I wanted to look at short-term implications and then long-term implications for the stage development theory. as well as for individuals. And I have the following that I'd like to propose. Short term, the initial conclusions on the hero's journey. And by the way, it is the hero who takes the journey, no matter what the resolution. I call each person the hero. Only because this summer I finally found this, and I've been kind of looking at this book. It was recommended to me a long, long time ago, and I never got a hold of Joseph Campbell. I only saw the video, The Power of a Myth. You probably remember that way back on PBS. Well, now I'm reading this work, finally, The Hero with a Thousand Faces. Okay, first point, in the initial conclusions, A, what do you do with this from my experiences, from my interviews? What do you do up front? And I just throw out these because this is what I've come to after examining this for the last 4 years. A, turn away from church members who are mean-spirited or ignorant. Where there is emotional toxicity, leave. That includes an ecclesiastical leader. Where there is cultural dysfunctionality, do not contribute to it. Shift gears. Or, for some people who know about certain trainings, step left. Spiritually turn towards the Savior rather than any institution. Seem to be a common thread through all. Or anyone who would think, feel, or act in accordance with your understanding of the Savior. Whether that be internal or external. I'll allow that for one who believes the Savior is external, or for one who told me that the Savior wound up... Well, didn't we have a movie about that this summer? Harry Potter? It wasn't his father, it was him. So whether the Savior is external to you or internal, much to your surprise and amazement, act in accordance with your own understanding. B, find others in your tribe as the first line of support, because you're going to need support. Because I was absolutely a first-hand witness to somebody who tried to make sense, and in their his resolution tried to come out and came out stillborn, dead on arrival, and had to go back and start the whole process over. Why? No support system. Certainly if that worked for African Americans 40 to 50 years ago, and I sure think about building tremendous communities of support to hang in and hold on while the marches began to be organized in the churches, whether it be in Birmingham and Selma, or Montgomery, or Chicago. Find the organization, find the group, find the lines of support, true support, because you're going to need every single ounce of it. But be shrewd as it certainly can work today, but be shrewd as a serpent, not innocent as a dove. Many of our brothers have been taken out by the adversary, or if you prefer, by the dark side. We've got two great metaphors going on in America, the religious tradition and the Star Wars secular tradition, Greek-Roman tradition. Take your pick. They are physically, even emotionally appealing, but are spiritually harmful, even toxic. Many do not have your own best interests at heart, but only their own worst. C, remember one powerful phrase, fulfill the measure of your creation by growing in the gospel so as to be a representative, a living example of Jesus and all that he embodies, if that is your tradition. And so remember that while a resume might describe a person as an accountant or a software developer, your heavenly resume can note you as a mentor, a healer, or even just a world-class friend. D, in the end, fill a need. Fulfill your mission. That's post-21 for those in the room who are RNs. There are all these other missions. There are many males who are in deep pain. Their pain is emotional, mental, and spiritual, with disinterested, frustrated, or even hostile family, friends, and school systems who have little, if any, time for or interest in these kids or adolescents or young adults. The need is great. Don't wait, but first get your own act together. We need new organizers. We need new role models. We need writers. We need midwives to help people come out not stillborn. I propose this. I hereby call forth the beginnings of a Leviticus project, named after the Genesis Project of the early 1970s for African Americans in the LDS Church. I am reminded of Leviticus because I know quite well of chapters 19, verse 18, and the penalties attached therein to those who act upon same-sex attraction, same-gender attraction. So, I'd say, let's start a Leviticus project. What kinds of things can be done underneath the umbrella of such a project? Here are some ideas. A, begin a serious dialogue with church leaders of any level, educating them regarding what science has come to learn in these past 5 years, and boy, I sure heard a whole lot more information today than I did even a year ago from some of those sitting in the audience right here in the last few hours. We have data. It is time. It has come time to stand for something. Thank you, President Hinckley. This will be difficult because of the politicization on both sides of the issue. That is, that the data is always questioned because everybody assumes post-1990-something that the data is completely politicized, whether it be on this side or that side. And so it's become very difficult for anybody to listen anymore. Thanks, Talk Radio, anyway, for that, giving us a jump start on not trusting anybody. Carry on anyway. B. Organize and align yourselves politically from this year's elections to next year's newspaper articles. Get involved. Read, reflect, write, speak, offer perspectives. Because your silence, anyone's silence, our silence, can be deafening. And tone out and tune out anything else that might be urgent, let alone important to speak of. C. Take on the gospel as never before, becoming first-class human beings. Then you will be called upon, even needed for the work that the Savior will call you to do. For it has come time for the saints to offer all of their talents so that the church can take the next giant step into its fullness. D. Gay and lesbian saints would like to offer talents that will surprise and delight the whole church. I hope that my research formally will now proceed into what I call G-squared, gifted and gay. There's only one doctoral dissertation written 3 years ago when I did an Eric search. The field is wide open, and I'm probably going to jump in, starting in about a week. So, President Hinckley, Elder Holland, even Elder Packer, it's time to listen. A new generation awaits your growth. So you better keep growing. I'm going to finish with the following. A poem that I just read 48 hours ago in New York City when I was visiting my family. And I was just amazed by this. It's by Rudyard Kipling, and I present it to everyone who needs a little prod, a little push to actually believe that you have something to say, that you can find your voice, that we can gain a vision of what needs to be done for the next great push towards truth and light so that there would be beauty and honor for the purpose of charity and joy. The poem is entitled, If. If you can keep your head when all about you are losing bears and blaming it on you, when all men doubt you, but make a... If you can wait and not be lied about, don't deal in lies. Or being hated, don't give way to hating. And yet don't look too good nor talk too wise. If you can dream and not make dreams your master, if you can think and not make thoughts your aim, if you can meet with triumph and disaster and treat those two imposters just the same, if you can bear to hear the truth you've spoken, twisted by knaves to make a trap for fools, or watch the things you gave your life to broken, and stoop and build them up with worn-out tools. If you can make one heap of all your winnings and risk it on one turn of pitch and toss, and lose and start again at your beginnings, and never breathe a word about your loss. If you can force your heart and nerve and sinew to serve your turn long after they are gone, and so hold on when there is nothing in you except the will which says to them, hold on. If you can talk with crowds and keep your virtue, or walk with kings nor lose the common touch. If neither foes nor loving friends can hurt you, if all men count with you but none too much, if you can fill the unforgiving minute with 60 seconds worth of distance run, yours is the earth and everything that's in it, and which is more, you'll be a man, my son. Thank you for your attention and consideration of these ideas. My respondent will now take some good time. Thank you.
Thanks, Dr. Coco. That was an exciting study that you're beginning to evaluate and share with us, and I like the idea of the 10-stage model. I'm going to speak for a few minutes giving voice to women's experiences coping with same-sex attraction. I'm presently working on my dissertation research that looks at the similar processes of sexual and spiritual development in women. Until a few years ago, I defined sexuality and spirituality as two opposite poles of a person, and there the two should meet. However, I was wondering lately, how do same-sex attracted women cope with the competing needs and desires of these two major components of our life experience? I've come to understand that sexuality and spirituality are very similar processes. Healthy sexuality encompasses an integration of all of our humanity, human processes, physical, emotional, cognitive, social, and spiritual dimensions. Both spirituality and sexuality are connecting forces with the universe that give our lives meaning and happiness. Spirituality and sexuality can and must live in harmony. While our American Christian culture generally dismisses or avoids discussions of sexuality, in other cultures, sexuality and spirituality are inextricably linked. The LDS Church, and others I presume, focus primarily on addressing and attempting to change men's same-sex attraction. There is significant research literature on men's experiences, while there is none primarily addressing women's experiences in same-sex attraction. There has not been a systematic effort to address women's same-sex attraction as there has been for men, and for that, we're probably lucky. Lesbian invisibility may be an advantage in this case. Lesbians hardly rate a line in the manual that bishops use for counseling homosexuals. In an earlier presentation today, there was a table shown of, I believe, six different research studies, and the participants and the outcomes of those research studies of LDS, same-sex attracted individuals. I calculated roughly that there were over 800 participants in total of these six studies, and 32 of them were women. So I don't know that we can say too much particularly about women's sexuality and their process, women's same-sex feelings and that process. While the emphasis on change does not publicly target women as intensely as men, women's intrapsychic contemplation of same-sex attraction is as powerful and heavy as men's. Women live with the same secrecy, confusion, anger, self-doubt, self-hatred, fear of being discovered, and shame. Women are also concerned about judgment in the afterlife. The most frequently reported reason for seeking therapy to change is a conflict between sexual feelings and religious convictions. Nonetheless, same-sex attraction must be addressed by both sexes through repentance and change in order to remain in good standing with the church. One researcher, Mahaffey, explored the challenges and the dissonance between Christian identification and lesbianism and found that her participants employed differing strategies to try to handle these competing beliefs. She had a sample of 163 lesbian Christians. 27% of the sample stated that they experienced no tension between their religious beliefs and their homosexuality. 38% reported a conflict between their personal religious beliefs and their lesbianism. Another 35% reported a conflict between their sexual identity and other people's religious convictions. So, in summary, 75% of the sample reported some experience of tension with their sexual feelings, their homosexual feelings, and their Christian beliefs. She concluded that the later a woman identified that she was a lesbian, the more likely she was to change her beliefs or leave her church. So the more ingrained the lesbian identity was in a woman, the more likely she was to have to change her religious beliefs or her spiritual beliefs. I'd like to present two tentative solutions in resolving this conflict for women. First, I encourage women to look at redefining their sexuality. Klein presented a model of sexual orientation that includes seven dimensions of sexuality, realizing that sexuality is not just straight or gay, but it is also sexual behavior, sexual attraction, sexual fantasies, emotional preference, social preference, self-identification, and lifestyle. Women's sexuality is more fluid than men's throughout our lifetimes, and women have a stronger bisexual potential than men do. To acknowledge and accept our varying sexuality may be of some comfort to some women. Secondly, in my research and also in my personal life, I choose the theoretical framework of spiritual maturity rather than religious development. I ask people, women, to think about not the religion that they belong to, but their spiritual relationships. Religion is a social experience with other people, in a church or in a congregation of such. Spirituality is a very individual process, a very individual experience. Religion can deepen spirituality, but it can also be a barrier to spiritual growth. And spirituality is reflexive, changing, unlike religion. I'm also a fan of stage theories, as you can see. A woman developed this model of spiritual maturity, which explores an individual's spirituality rather than their religious behavior. I realize that this may not be an acceptable alternative in seeking reconciliation for some people, for accepting one's same-sex attraction involves many losses, as Dr. Kokel illustrated in his model. Indoctrination in any religion is a powerful experience. When seeking harmony between one's sexual orientation and spirituality, the additional losses of your religious community and your religious family exacerbate the grieving. The hero's journey that Dr. Kokel spoke of is undertaken by one who feels something is lacking in the normal experiences available or permitted to members of his or her society. Let's take a look, thinking of a hero's journey through these stages at the spiritual maturity model. The egocentric faith is a childlike faith. It's also very dichotomous, either good or evil, no in between, much like child thinking is. A dogmatic faith is the next stage, where it's what I call by the book faith. As a child or a young person learns more about their particular religion and dogma, the focus is on earning God's love and approval through that route of that religion. Thirdly is a transitional faith, which involves spiritual uncertainty and doubt, questioning of the religion that we were assigned to by our parents. Fourth is reconstructed internalized faith, a commitment to a self-chosen faith, which may be the one in which we were raised, that provides meaning, purpose, and spiritual fulfillment. And finally, a transcendent faith, which is something I certainly attempt to try to ascribe to, a faith that transcends personal motives, to develop and experience a sense of community with people of all faiths and with my higher power. Universal ideals and humanitarian secular efforts are primary rather than particularly my standing with my higher power. So, in thinking about the hero and the hero's journey, for which every one person in this room is, in the journey that each one of us has taken, in our interest in same-sex attraction, if not our personal feeling about it, personal experience of it. The hero looks for something more to commit their lives to, looks for a life elixir, is what Joseph Campbell talks about, some sort of treasure that defies the ordinary meaning on our own world about that. It's a sacrifice of the individual. The individual must be spiritually prepared, or else they will face a psychological crisis along the way. I do not believe that accepting and living our sexuality over our spirituality is a selfish decision. Giving voice, meaning, and unconditional love to same-sex attracted individuals is a spiritual deed of heroic proportions. Not all heroes are men. Historically, men are more conspicuously heroes, just because of the conditions of life, and women are in the home. I applaud Dr. Kochel's call for the Levitical Project and respectfully request that women's concerns be equally represented. Present this as a conflict and a problem for women also, not just men. If 10% of the population is gay, then 5% of that population are women. There are probably women in the audience who are here to support men who have same-sex attraction. I want to ask you, have you reached out recently to a woman acquaintance who also has same-sex attraction? Would you please? Often I find myself reflecting about someone in my life who has just accomplished something absolutely marvelous. I often refer to these individuals as my heroes of the week. This week I don't have one, but many. Dr. Kochel and the Sunstone Organization are two of the biggest on my current list. I'm also here for another reason today. I am still seeking participants for my research. If you know of a woman who attempted to change her same-sex attraction to become heterosexual, would you please come up and take one of these recruitment announcements? Women may enter this voluntarily, and many women are referred or coerced into it from authorities, family authorities, or religious authorities in their lives. I'd like to speak to any and all women, no matter how they identify today, whether it's lesbian, asexual, bisexual, heterosexual. The therapy also is broadly defined as therapy either with a mental health practitioner or with a religious authority. And I am getting some response, but I feel that again, lesbian invisibility in this case today is not working in my favor. So if you know of someone, I'd appreciate your thoughts. Thank you very much.
I have a dog-eared piece of paper that I've kept for 50 years. It was given to me when I was younger by Duff Hanks. And it says, truly speaking, it is not instruction that one can receive from another, but provocation. I feel provoked by both of our presenters today and would like to thank them. Among the significant amount of new data that Marty referred to is a significant amount of information suggesting biological connections to homosexuality. Interestingly, those data suggest that to the degree that biology is involved, the pathways are not the same in men and women. I'm grateful to have Mary remind us about the need to accumulate greater information about our lesbian sisters. And I also feel to remark that though seldom given the kind of recognition they deserve as heroes, women perform that role in a quiet and thoughtful and provocative way, and Mary has exemplified that. I'm sure that you have been provoked with some questions, and we'd like now to have an opportunity to hear from you and to have Marty and Mary respond to things that you're now thinking about. Please come up so that and use the mic so we can all hear your question or comment.
I had a comment I wanted to make. It's a little bit of a critique. I hear a lot in the circles that I'm a part of, especially down at BYU or different churches, that within the church, that we just don't know a lot about this. And I think that there's a tremendous disservice that is being done in the church by the academic people who are well educated and represent and are the ones that diffuse this information to the common people. And maybe I shouldn't say this, but there's a tremendous amount of literature about same-sex relationships. There's, if you look in the journals, the last 10 years or 20 years of any discipline in the sciences, you're going to find dozens and dozens of articles about same-sex relationships, about the genetics, about whatever aspect of this you want to find. And for example, you've come up with an interesting 10-step thing. Well, there's a whole theory about identity development for homosexuals. There's, I can think of 8 studies that have been done about Mormon homosexuals dealing with different aspects of their struggle, and they deal with the development within the reparative therapy. I think there's, the problem is, within the church, we want to stress heterosexual marriage, and in my field, we're trying to fight homosexuality by promoting marriage. And there's a problem with that. You can't talk about same-sex relationships without studying it. How do you disprove same-sex relationships by pushing marriage? So I just want to say there is these types of theories, and I hope you'll do some research, because this isn't frontier. There is a tremendous amount of literature that talk about this. It's not something that we don't know very much about, as most Mormons think. It just shows our own ignorance, and I'm sorry for that. I think the people at BYU and my department and other departments are doing a disservice to the church by not exposing them to the literature that's there. It's published in the same journals as the marriage literature that they promote. It has the same controls, the same requirements of academic the requirements that you have to fulfill, the controls on the research. It's there is a lot of research out there. This isn't a brand new thing. So I challenge anyone that's interested in this to dig a little deeper. Don't just take the word for it. We don't know very much about this, because that's not true.
And causes of and changing and possibility of changing do appear in the journals. However, I have to say that we don't know very much about it, in my humble opinion. Most, I would say at least 50%, probably more of those articles are all theoretical in nature. It's part of a dialogue, or I should say an argument, I guess, between the religious right and between the gay affirmative psychologists who are saying reparative therapy is unethical. Yeah, but people deserve to have reparative therapy if they want. Yeah, but you are in a position of power and you are the one who's controlling the client. Yeah, but the client wants to do this because it is not in sync with their religious beliefs, their moral beliefs. So there are a lot of articles. However, most of them are just thoughtful. They're not research. They don't have samples. There are very few that do have samples. I know of several also. I don't know about eight. I don't know how many exactly that specifically address the LDS population. At least 50% of those were done with the help of Dr. Dean Bird at the University of Utah, who is very pro-reparative therapy, very pro-NARTH, if you're familiar with their organization. Those also are not often published in mainstream journals. They're published in AMCAP, for example, is where I've found several of them, or the NARTH journal, which comes out monthly. So I would maintain that we don't know very much about it. The evidence is not conclusive by any means. You know, people say that there is a biological component for men's homosexuality. That may be the case, but it's certainly not proven by any means. LaVey's entire sample were all men who died of AIDS. So it's really rather difficult to make that jump that because their hypothalamus was different than heterosexual men, that meant it was because they were gay, where the disease may have had a very strong possibility there. Secondly, thirdly, your last point about the theories of identity development, there are lots of theories about homosexual identity development. I agree with you. I found about at least six specifically about women's sexual identity development, and that doesn't include the one about men's. However, I will say that I am not familiar with one at all, except for Lee Beckstead's, which he has just begun to address and publish in the last couple of years, that takes a look at the sincerity and the very powerful influence of religion and spirituality. In all of the identity development models that I've looked at before, they don't take a look at our moral thought or our moral priorities as well. And if you are familiar with some of them, I'd love to see them because I don't know them. So those are my responses, is I appreciate what you have to say. And if you can get me an audience with BYU or any church leaders, I would be happy to participate. Thank you.
Thanks, Gary. I wanted to also just clarify. I, on purpose, did not come on an August 14th, hoping that this was still summertime. I really didn't want to go way north. I didn't want to go to my head. I didn't want this to be fairly academic and do Chapter 2 review of the literature kind of a presentation, although I've heard two excellent ones today. This particular time, I wanted to begin and find my own voice by offering something a little bit fairly light. Three very, very at length interviews, one of them extremely close to home. I'll just leave it at that. And just allow that voice to kind of be fleshed out. I do apologize for not citing the first piece for me, 1997, Chandler Burr's A Separate Creation, involving his whole discussion on the XQ28 chromosome. I could go in that direction, but I chose not to today. And I just want to just clarify with you that I did this work on purpose so that it's sort of on the other end of the spectrum intellectually, if that's possible. But to clarify.
Please, come on. I liked your, seven ways of describing sexuality. Mm-hmm. What were they again?
I got social preference.
I'm not sure I can remember all seven.
Sexual behavior, the obvious ones, I guess, first. Sexual attraction.
Fantasy.
Sexual fantasies. Emotional preference.
Lifestyle.
Hetero or gay lifestyle, thanks. Emotional preference, social preference. And self-identification. Mm-hmm. It's Klein and Sepikoff. It's their theoretical model from about 1985.
What's the first name of Klein?
I don't know. I don't. Oh, let me see.
Thank you.
F. Klein. Mm-hmm.
Can you go from step 2 to step 7?
Yeah. Can you skip to a 10?
No. Yeah, yes, I do.
I mean, and the question is, it would also be interesting, given your MS3, to talk about, you know, did you see people who dealt with certain sections of those steps better or figured out a way to go from one down to others without kind of crisis or reaction or anything like that?
Right. What I wanted to propose is really listen in on three very, very powerful stories and bring those stories forward. I used the initials to protect their privacy because to live close by, and I just wanted to protect their jobs, their identity, you know, for that reason. What I wanted to let you know is that steps or stages, very clearly, can you go from stage 1 to F, to so A, I put letters down, A to F to J, yes. Can you go from A to G to B? In other words, can you bounce around? Does it have to be sequential? No. And thank you to an audience. I was able to present stage development for Intentions of the Heart to an audience in Aarhus, Denmark, who warned me, don't go taxonomy here. Don't sit there and demand that you have to go A, B, C, D, E, F, G. Just bounce around, and people can have their own stories. I just laid out that that's what I heard in a compilation of all three, and they were very, very clear to me that each one of these, of the three of them, went through all of the stages, some in a matter of moments, others wallowing for months in, let's say, a stage G. All three were devout Latter-day Saints. All three took the journey seriously. That is the journey to find sexual identity, to uncover, therefore, then what to do with sexual identity. But then also chose to go through every piece step at a time. It was kind of an interesting, I guess I found them and found the stories fascinating enough to bring them and to not, that I was aware that I wanted to really uncover and unpack what's going on here if I could just almost split hairs. I think there was one stage I was wondering whether I've done too much splitting, I mean 10 stages. Again, A, stage development theory. And again, not all 10 to be done by anyone in particular, but I heard all 10 in all three's voices. But yes, I'm completely open to it missing a few. There's some a lot of negative attachment until you get to resolution. But I listened to the stories, and there was a whole lot of pain mixed in with pleasure. A lot of joy mixed in with grief. A lot of happiness. Yeah, the opposition in all things. I'm very comfortable with that. Happiness with sadness. So I really wanted to just identify this birthing process. And I pleaded with the audience, I hope I included it, that we desperately, desperately need midwives in this process of giving birth to self. That sexual identity, whether it occur at age 12 or 16 or 24 or 41, is this process of, can we just use the expression to be born yet again? Especially if there has been denial, repression, pushing people over to heterosexuality. And there has to be this new opportunity to be born yet again. Yes?
Yeah, this would be for either one of you. And I'm again interested, I'm blown away by that, by Klein's seven steps or whatever, seven areas. Do you suggest, or did they in their study suggest taking each, I mean, that a person would have gotten through each of those areas separately, or does it happen all at once? I'm sure I'm not being very clear in my question, but it seems like each one of those areas is very different from the other areas. Mm-hmm. We tend to think of them as all the same thing.
Right.
And yet, if you've accomplished one, you very well could be at stage one in the other areas. So what I just would like for you to talk about that.
Mm-hmm. First of all, I don't think that there is such a thing probably as accomplishing one of them. I don't know what accomplishment would be. Those are all seven processes that we all have today, that we all had when we were 13, that we all had when we were 21, or will have when we're 21. Those are just seven different pieces of us, rather than for me to say, I'm a lesbian. And then you say, okay, I know what a lesbian is. A lesbian is a woman who sleeps with women, who thinks about women, who lives with women, who prefers women, who hates men, and who won't engage in the straight world. Right? That's not who I am. I have, you know, there are different, I'm on a continuum here in all those different areas. Many, many straight, heterosexual people have fantasies about same-sex love. Many women or men, women particularly, I guess I'm more familiar with, have a very strong emotional attachment to another woman, but yet are happy in a heterosexual marriage. So those, it just really looks at the complexity of our sexuality, not just women's, but men's also. So all those things are happening today and yesterday and tomorrow for us. And instead of, you know, the two kind of beginning definitions, that you're either heterosexual or you're homosexual, then we can look at, you know, 90% of us, according to the Kinsey studies, fit in the middle of that. You know, and that's what this speaks to, is that I can call myself a lesbian, but I may still have dreams about romantic involvement with men, or I may occasionally fantasize about sexual behavior with men, vice versa for other people too. So you have to look at all those pieces rather than just make presumptions about people. That's one thing I'm saying is when you get to a point of identity integration, which is the last stage in many of these development theories, where you're okay with your sexuality and you live it and you don't give any more energy to it than you do to any other part of your life, really your sexuality becomes almost, you know, it's insignificant. And so I'm saying, why do we have to identify ourselves as same-sex attracted in all of our audiences where we're probably sharing a lot of the same sexual feelings or thoughts as many other people? So I guess I'm also, I'm most comfortable when women, when people label themselves rather than me assuming you're straight or you're gay or you're confused or you're on your way, you know, or you've chosen to opt out of sexual life because it's too confusing. So I'm most comfortable with whatever people's own identification is.
I just want to just follow up on that. I like that model a lot because I just don't think people want to deal with the complexity of the issue.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's just so complex. I mean, like in the media, you see, you know, somebody, the governor from New Jersey that just came out. So we all know who he is. You know, he's a gay American. I mean, I think there's probably so much more to that story that, you know, that we'll, you know, we will never know, and probably we shouldn't know. It's his private business. But we like to think we know what that means, and, you know, I don't even know myself.
And especially to use it to discriminate against people. Nobody, you know, even the governor of New Jersey didn't say, I've successfully lived heterosexually for 30, 40 years, and I've now had one episode of a gay love affair. You know, that doesn't make him a gay American. But we don't know how else to define that, except... So it's easy for us to be open to discrimination because of that. He was a fine governor probably last week, you know, in many folks' eyes, and today he's not because of that unfortunate label for other people.
You know, I'm sort of a childhood friend of Mark's from when he grew up at 9. I'm sort of struck by how much hope there is in this discussion and actually for the future. I was living in San Francisco in the late 1970s, early 80s, when the first gay Jewish synod was formed in. And I was powerfully struck by how important that was to my gay and lesbian Jewish friends to have a place to go to call their own within our Jewish tradition, but which was a gay synagogue. Now, that was 1978. This morning, I'm sitting in Kol Ami, a synagogue here in Salt Lake, and our rabbi is a lesbian. 25 years ago, there would have been no way in this earth or any other earth for Kol Ami to have a lesbian rabbi. But because in San Francisco, in 1978, a group of gay Jews came together, formed a minyan, found a lay rabbi to lead it, that started something of a snowball, which led to not only gay and lesbian rabbis within the Reformed Jewish tradition, but within sort of the mid-range conservative Jewish tradition. The other thing that strikes me, though, is I know that Marty, in his action plan, talked about the importance of trying to, and I am Jewish, not LDS, so take this with a grain of, no, take this with a pound of salt. The importance of trying to speak with LDS religious leaders about this issue. It strikes me a bit like trying to take down Gibraltar with a death attack. You know, it is a very, very difficult thing.